And as we are right at the top of the hour, I'd like to introduce our person from the Office of Health Equity, Lauren Korshak, who's a translation lead in the Office of Health Equity, and she's going to do introductions for our other presenters. So, Lauren, can I turn things over to you? Lauren, if you're talking, we can't hear you. You must still be muted.
I was still muted. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. So I am Lauren Korshak. I am with the Office of Health Equity, and I really want to thank you all for joining us today. Just a little background about Office of Health Equity. We were created in 2012, and you know, we were created to ensure that veterans' health provides appropriate and individualized health care to each veteran in a way that eliminates disparate health outcomes and assures health equity. So we have a quick poll. True or false, health disparities do not exist within VHA because it's a nationally integrated healthcare system.
And Lauren, that poll is up and running currently. People are providing their answers. We have about 50% of your attendees answered, and so we're going to give people a few more moments to provide their answers. Usually levels off around 80%, so.
Okay.
It has leveled off, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share out the results. And surprise, surprise, 4% say that that's true, and 96% say that that's false. And now we're back on your slides.
Great. And so the answer is false. The good news is that while disparities do exist within VHA, they tend to be smaller than the disparities that are found outside of VHA. So we are doing really important work. So the goals of our office, one, strengthen VA leadership to address health inequities and reduce disparities, raise awareness and increase awareness of health inequalities and disparities, improve health outcomes for veterans that are experiencing health disparities, improve cultural and linguistic competency and diversity of the VHA workforce, and finally, data, research, and evaluation. Improve data and diffusion of research to achieve health equity. So we focus on veterans, our populations, for health equity, we focus on veterans who experience greater obstacles to health related to race, ethnicity, gender, age, geographic location, religion, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, mental health conditions, the era in which they served in the military, and disabilities. And so this is just a quick snapshot of our team. Dr. Ernest Moy is our executive director. And then the work that we do is put into three different components. One is our data and analysis. Dr. Washington at the Los Angeles VA, Palo Alto VA, does a lot of that work. And our point of contact here at Health Equity is Dr. Kenneth Jones. Dr. Leslie Hausman is at Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and she does some of the translation work from the field. And then I am the point of contact for translation work within the office here in D.C. And then finally, dissemination. Tony Powell is our point of contact, and we work with the Center for Minority Veterans and the Health Equity Coalition around those efforts. So here's my plug to please go and visit our website. We're constantly updating it with new materials to include available today a fact sheet on obesity disparities, and the data in it is from today's presentation. So it is on the homepage in the banner. It's the third banner that will show up. It's also down at the bottom under what's new on the homepage and on publications and research. So it's in three different places. So hopefully you'll be able to find it. Today's presentation is something that I'm really personally very interested in. Before coming to the Office of Health Equity, I practiced as a clinical exercise physiologist and oversaw exercise and stress management components of a lifestyle intervention for veterans with comorbidities at the Washington, D.C. VA. So I've also explored and published on the relationship between chronic disease, exercise capacity, and mortality. And I've been fortunate enough to have been interviewed by television news radio channels regarding the importance of engaging in healthy behavior. So this is something that I'm personally very excited about and would like to go ahead and introduce today's presenters. Jessica Breland will be going first. She's a licensed psychologist and a core investigator and CDA awardee at the Center for Innovation and Implementation at the VA Palo Alto Healthcare System. Dr. Breland received her PhD in psychology from Rutgers and completed her clinical internship at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Her work focuses on using quantitative and qualitative methods to assess outcomes related to the implementation of evidence-based treatments, especially through controlled trials in novel settings like primary care, or with novel methods like apps. And she identifies and reduces, she aims to work to identify and reduce racial and ethnic disparities in health. She's also interested in enhancing care for patients with chronic conditions such as obesity or diabetes. Lisa Gualtieri is an assistant professor at Tufts University of Medicine in the Department of Public Health and Community Medicine, where she's the director of the Digital Health Communication Certificate Program. Her research focuses on the use of wearable activity trackers with underserved populations, the integration of tracker data into clinical care, and the impact of digital literacy skills on the adoption of digital health by older adults. Dr. Gualtieri is the founder of Recycle Health, a nonprofit that collects wearable activity trackers to donate to underserved populations. She serves on the FDA's General Hospital and Personal Use Devices panel. Dr. Gualtieri has a PhD in computer science from Harvard University, an SCM in computer science from Brown University, and a BA in mathematics from the University of Massachusetts. And she tweets at Lisa Gualtieri. So I'd like to go ahead and hand our presentation over to Dr. Breland.
Great, thank you. Let me just get my slides up here for everyone. Okay, so I gave a somewhat similar presentation on a cyber seminar in the past, and these data are actually based on a program evaluation that was funded by the VA Office of Women's Health Services and the Office of Health Equity, and we published the data I'll talk about today and more information actually in a manuscript in the Journal of General Internal Medicine, so I included a link for that at the end of my slide deck. I should also say I'm supported by a VA Health Services Research and Development Career Development Award. I don't have any conflicts of interest, and the views represented here are mine, don't represent those of the VA or the US government. So getting into my poll question.
Jessica, that poll question has been launched. Okay. The question being, what is your primary role? Answers being clinician, researcher, trainee, or something else. And if it's something else, please let us know by using the questions pane. Just put your answers in there. And we have about 70% of your attendees voted. We're going to let it go probably until about 80% because that's where things level off. And we do have a number of people entering things in the other category. Things have leveled off. I'm going to close the poll and share out the results. And Jessica, 58% of your attendees chose clinician. They say that they're clinician. 18% are researchers. 3% are trainees. And 20% say something else. And that something else are food systems manager, educator / admin who supports researchers, CHW program coordinator, public health official, project manager, diabetic, program office team manager, and project manager. We're back on
Great,
your slide.
Great, thank you. Glad we have such a diverse group here. So I like to start all my talks about obesity with this slide because I think it gives a really good overview of the various medical complications of obesity, including things that are sort of the usual suspects like stroke, heart disease, diabetes, as well as things that are related to obesity but less commonly thought of in relation to obesity, like cancer or arthritis. You can really see the range of effects that obesity has here. I also like to show these CDC maps of obesity prevalence across the United States because it really gives you a sense of the scope of the problem. You can see that as you go from, as you go from the green states to the yellow to the red, you're going from less obesity prevalence to more obesity prevalence. So you can see there are quite a lot of states that have a population where at least 30% of people have obesity. These maps also let you see how the obesity burden differs across different populations. So this is for the whole U.S. population. If you look at it for just Hispanic adults, you can see more yellow, more orange, more red, corresponding with higher obesity rates. And if you look at non-Hispanic Black adults, you can see even more red, corresponding with that highest prevalence group. So to me, what these maps suggest is that because there are these disparities in obesity rates, it's possible that treating or preventing obesity could reduce disparities in obesity-related conditions like diabetes or hypertension. And that sort of brings us to our topic for today. We didn't really have recent data on obesity prevalence among veterans who use VA. We knew there were these differences in the general population. We wanted to see if they existed within VHA also. So we did a program evaluation to answer this question. What are obesity rates among veterans using primary care services and VHA? We developed a cohort using VA clinical administrative data on veteran primary care users in fiscal year 2014. So we had about 350,000 women, a little over 4.5 million men, and then we looked at all of those patients and calculated the number and proportion who had obesity or a BMI greater than or equal to 30. I won't go into detail about how we did that. It was pretty time consuming. There's details in the manuscript. But basically, because VA clinicians are so good at capturing weights at almost every visit, we were able to calculate a BMI for about 98 or 99% of primary care patients who were seen that year. We then looked at the rates across a number of populations. We started by stratifying our cohort by gender because we know that there are differences between women and men who use VA. The women tend to be younger, they tend to be more racially and ethnically diverse, and they tend to have a different comorbidity burden. And then we also looked at rates across a number of subpopulations within gender, including race, ethnicity, mental health conditions, age, physical health conditions, urban, rural status, disability status, and service era. Those are both populations that are of interest to the Office of Health Equity and have been related to obesity disparities in other work. For this presentation, I'm just going to focus on the populations I've highlighted here in red, just for the sake of time, but there's data on all these other groups in the manuscript that I link to at the end. So getting into the broad overview of the BMI distribution among these women and men, veteran primary care users, in fiscal year 2014, you can see that 44% of women had obesity, they're represented by orange here, and 41% of men had obesity, they're represented in blue. 31% of women and 38% of men had overweight, and about a quarter of both women and men were normal weight or were underweight. Getting into some of these subpopulations by gender, we'll start with obesity prevalence, obesity rates by race, ethnicity, status among women. And on this slide and on the slides that follow, the darker colored bars are going to represent groups who had at least a 5% difference between the obesity rates in their population and the general population mean of 41% because we considered that a clinically significant difference in rates. We didn't do statistical analyses, I should be clear. So in terms of race ethnicity for women, we found particularly high rates of obesity among the Black or African American women and the Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islander women. And then the Asian women had a relatively low obesity rate at 21%. When you look at men, there are similarities and differences. Similar to the women, the Asian men had a relatively low obesity rate at 25%, but the groups with the highest rates were a little bit different for men. It was the American Indian, Alaska Native men, and the men whom we didn't have race ethnicity data who had that difference in rates from the population as a whole. We also wanted to look at mental health conditions because we know that there is a link between obesity and mental health. So this shows obesity rates for women veterans with a variety of mental health conditions. You can see a lot of dark bars here. These aren't mutually exclusive groups, which may be important. But you can see women with schizophrenia had a particularly high obesity rate at 56%. It was also pretty high among women with major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and PTSD. And the rates were a bit lower among women who had drug or alcohol use disorders. As with before, the men, there are similarities and differences from the women. So as with the women, men with alcohol or drug use disorders had relatively low rates. Men with major depressive disorder, PTSD, or bipolar disorder had relatively high rates of obesity. But we don't see those very high rates of obesity among the men with schizophrenia. So that seems to be one gender difference. So finally, I'll end with this data dump by talking about differences in obesity prevalence across age groups. Among women, we found a particularly high rate among the middle-aged women who were 45 to 64 years. And we found a similar finding among the men. The middle-aged men also had a pretty high obesity rate at 48%. We also found a relatively low obesity rate among the men who were age 65. And older. In terms of key points to take away from all of this, one thing I want to stress is that it's actually difficult to make comparisons from the data I just presented to the general U.S. population because there are differences between veterans who use VA and other people in the United States. Veterans who use VA tend to be older, they're much more likely to be male, and they also tend to be in poorer health than the average person in the U.S., so I don't want to over-extrapolate from our findings, and I wouldn't want anyone else to do that either. But I do think there are a few groups that we can highlight. And one of those things I want to talk about are the high obesity rates we found among young men. So they had an obesity rate of 46%, which didn't quite meet our threshold for clinical significance, but is quite high and actually seems to differ from what you see in the general U.S. population. The CDC estimates that for men age 20 to 39, their obesity prevalence is about 32%. So that's quite different. And given the long horizon of these young men in getting their care from VA, it does seem like if we can help them manage their weight, we might be able to prevent a number of debilitating and potentially expensive chronic conditions in that population. I also wanted to highlight the high rates among veterans with mental health conditions, especially women with schizophrenia. There are lots of reasons for this, including the fact that some medications for mental health conditions can lead to obesity. So it's not entirely surprising, but I do think it really suggests that there may be a need for treatments that can combine mental health care with weight management, be that in a mental health clinic or in a primary care office. I also wanted to highlight the high rates among Black women at 51%. That's somewhat similar to the general U.S. population. Similarly, we saw those low rates among Asian men and women, which you also see in the general U.S. population. Although in the U.S. population, the rates for Asian populations tend to be lower than what we found. At the same time, talking about these racial and ethnic differences brings us to one of the key limitations of this work, which is that BMI is an imperfect predictor of health, perhaps particularly when you're trying to compare across race and ethnicity. We know that BMI seems to confer different risks depending on your background. So Asian populations may be at greater risk at lower BMIs, which may mean that we're underestimating the risk for our Asian veterans. And African American populations seem to be at lower risk at higher BMIs, so we may be overestimating the risk for our African American women. So it's certainly a limitation. At the same time, BMI is very consistently linked to negative health outcomes, so I don't think we need to get rid of it entirely. I just think it's important to keep all of these things in mind as we interpret this information. Our race and ethnicity groupings are also somewhat problematic. We actually had much more fine-grained detail than you typically see in analyses of this kind, but we still lumped together different groups of Hispanic veterans, different groups of Asian veterans, so hopefully we'll be able to see more nuanced analyses of that at some point in the future. And as I said, we really can't compare these results from those to the general U.S. population, so that's certainly another limitation. In terms of future directions, one thing I think will be really important to do is to understand treatment use among some of these high-risk populations. So we see that high obesity prevalence among Black women, are they using weight management services at rates commensurate to that risk? And I think VA is a great place to think about those questions because veterans who use VA have access to a free evidence-based weight loss program that's called MOVE. I also think it may be necessary to develop tailored outreach or intervention efforts. If there are specific groups that are at especially high risk, we may want to focus on them. And as we do this, both clinically and research-wise, it's going to be important to consider this idea of intersectionality, or the idea that everybody has different facets of their identity, some of which confer privilege, some of which confer risk, and it's really in understanding how all of those different pieces interact and fit together that we're able to fully understand people's health and their risk for future health problems. So in terms of implications, I think the high obesity rates that we found in primary care patients in VA suggest that a population health approach to weight management is warranted. VA seems to take that approach. As I mentioned, there's MOVE, which is available to all veterans and doesn't cost anything for them. There are also a number of other physical therapy and nutrition and other programs that can help veterans manage their weight. I do think it'll be important for us to pay attention to the high-risk groups because it may be that they require special attention to make sure whatever systems improvements we make at the population level don't inadvertently increase health disparities. So if we try to, say, increase access to MOVE by increasing the number of clinicians who can offer it during the day, that's great, and that will help veterans who can come during the day. But we saw those really high rates of obesity among middle-aged veterans who tend to be working and might not be able to come in during the day. So what we could actually see in that case is a widening of the disparity between people who can get daytime treatment and those who might need after-hours services. So that's always important to keep in mind when you're talking about disparities. So with that, I would like to do my last poll question.
That poll is up. And the question is, what do you think is the most important future direction? Answers being outreach efforts tailored to specific populations, weight loss programs tailored to specific populations, statistical analyses to describe differences among VHA populations, and I'm sorry that got cut off, analyses to compare VHA and non-VHA obesity rates, or something else. And if it's something else, please go ahead and use the questions pane to give your answers. And answers are coming in a little bit slower this time around, Jessica, so we'll have to give people a little bit more time to give their answers. And we have about 60%, so just a few more moments. Here we go, things have leveled off at high rate, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share the results out. And 37% think that the most important future direction is outreach efforts tailored to specific populations. 51% say weight loss programs tailored to specific populations. Only 5% say statistical analyses to describe differences among VHA populations. Only 6% say analyses to compare VHA and non-VHA obesity rates. And 2% say something else. And one person said meeting the needs of employed vets. So I'm going to go ahead and close that, and we're back on your slides.
Okay, thank you. Always interesting to hear what people think. And that's the end of my presentation. I want to say thank you again to Women's Health Services, the Office of Health Equity and HSR&D for supporting this work, as well as the Women's Health Evaluation Initiative, which supplied the data we used. Want to certainly acknowledge the co-authors on the manuscript of this data who are listed here, as well as Ilan Helu, who was a research assistant who really helped getting all of that data organized. So I'll end with my contact information, my Twitter handle, and also, as I said, a link to the manuscript that gives more detail on the information I talked about today on different populations and also on the rates of overweight as well as obesity. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Lisa Gualtieri, and it's an honor to follow Jessica's presentation, and thanks to Lauren for inviting me to participate in the webinar today. I'm going to be talking about the use of activity tracker technology to facilitate healthy behavior. And I'll say three things quickly. The first is I have nothing to disclose. The second is that I typically only wear one tracker at a time. And the third is that I was recently honored to receive an AARP Purpose Prize Fellowship, and part of that stems out of the work I've been doing with Recycle Health, which I'll be talking about in a minute. So I'd like to start by talking about activity trackers, and there are shows taking place, I believe this week, the Consumer Electronics Show, and there's this endless array of digital health devices that are currently available. Trackers are one of the ones that have been around the longest, and they have a rich history, starting with pedometers and even people logging their activity on paper, keeping it in their heads, and so on. As consumer-grade devices, these are devices that became extremely popular and that many people use as a way of tracking their activity. We became particularly interested in what they actually do and how they actually help people. And before I go into that, I would like to ask a poll question. Rob?
Okay, and that poll question is up. Audience members, please select one or more. I currently use a tracker. I currently own a tracker I don't use. I have never owned a tracker, or I use my smartphone or smartwatch to track. And Lisa, we have about 70% voted, so it's probably going to be only a few seconds before people are finished. And yeah, things have leveled off, so I'm going to go ahead and close the poll and share out the results. And 37% of your audience currently use a tracker, 16% own a tracker they don't use, 23% have never owned a tracker, and 23% use their smartphone or smartwatch. And we're back on your slides.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. That's actually very helpful to know. And I think not very surprising, given what I learned from Jessica's polling question about what people do who are attending today. So who buys trackers? Pictures like this are probably things that you've seen before. They're very much marketed towards younger, fit-looking people, often clad in spandex. And age-wise, it's pretty much what you'd expect. Heaviest purchasers are 18 to 34-year-olds, who are also generally the healthiest segment of our adult population. Some other studies have shown that many are wealthier or have more disposable income, so that purchasing this kind of technology isn't burdensome for them. So about a third of tracker owners abandon their devices within 6 months, and that includes people who both stop using a tracker because they don't like it, they didn't find it helpful, or who stop using it to upgrade to a newer device. And what we started to look at is who might benefit most from trackers. And this is what was the root of Recycle Health. So I'm sure many of you had the experience that you're up late at night working on something, and I was preparing a lecture and looking at some of the data on demographics of tracker use and abandonment of trackers. And in my sleep, basically came up with the gem of the idea of Recycle Health, asking what if trackers no longer in use were collected and provided to the people who may benefit the most. And I just kind of ran with that, and we started Recycle Health 4 years ago as a 501c3 at Tufts University School of Medicine. We've had media mentions in the Boston Globe, USA Today, ABC News, and other places, and that, along with, as you can see, our abundant social media, has led to visibility in most search engines. We've also been fortunate enough to have some celebrity mentions, including by George Foreman III and by Matt Damon when he was in Boston being trained by one of my former students. In terms of what we've done to date, we have collected over 4,000 trackers, and this is ones that come in envelopes to us. Sometimes people who empty out their junk drawers and send in a number of them to us, along with extra bands and chargers. We've also been fortunate enough to get donations of essentially last year's models from some of the tracker vendors, and from corporate wellness programs that overpurchased. And we take the trackers that we get and we distribute them to a number of organizations, which we loosely call underserved populations. And it's been really exciting to have the opportunity to do this, in some cases just providing the trackers to organizations, in some cases doing this as part of research. As we were delving into this, we started to ask lots and lots of questions, and I know this is a bit overwhelming, but I'll just address the bottom four. So one of the things that we started to be curious about is why is 10,000 steps the default goal? And we discovered that this came out of a Japanese pedometer that was sold in the 60s, and its name translated to 10,000 steps. And this is something that is an interesting historical fact, but it's also something that we found quite significant because many people don't know that it's a default, and they don't know what might be a more reasonable initial step goal. And if you look at things like abandonment rate, it may be that some people start using a tracker and become very discouraged because 10,000 steps is beyond the capabilities of many people. We also have done a number of surveys, and one of the things we became quite interested in was how people acquire trackers, and then, interestingly, what are the broader implications? And we've been looking at different theoretical frameworks for behavior change, and one of the questions that we've asked is, if somebody receives a tracker, as a gift through a corporate wellness program, or if they make the decision to go out and purchase it, does that impact their sustained engagement? So that's not a question that we have an answer to, but we're also interested in where do people get stuck. And Additionally, we're very interested in how this kind of information can be integrated into clinical care. So in particular, what happens if physicians recommend it, and does that change how people perceive the trackers? And then also, are people willing to share their data with their clinical care team, which most people are? At the same time, we're aware that physicians have many time constraints, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at as part of the research that we're doing. There are reports of inaccuracy. One of the questions that I've long asked is, are they consistently inaccurate? Like, if your scale is set 5 pounds too high or 5 pounds too low, at least you're getting the same reading day after day, or are they actually variable? The general feeling on the part of physicians is that they're accurate enough to be useful. So the pilot study that we did was working with a physician-led wellness group, and this was a small group with 10 participants, but it gave us an opportunity to start asking some of the questions that we were particularly interested in. Because there were health outcomes being tracked, we knew that people lost on average a 0.5 pound a week, which is a very healthy loss, and also that there was a decrease in LDL levels. When we were surveying people, we conducted phone interviews, and we were interested in people's attitudes towards receiving the trackers, using the trackers, and then sustained engagement with the trackers. And some of the significant things that we learned, we had thought that cost was a barrier for many people. We learned that there were many other factors as well. And a number of people in the wellness group said that they had stood in a store in front of this array of trackers and had no idea which brand to buy and which model to buy, and so just didn't get one. They also didn't know if it was going to be helpful, unlike things like a smartphone, which people spend a lot of money on, but they know how it's going to get integrated into their lifestyle. Finally, we found that ongoing support was an issue for people, that for many people, setting up the tracker was difficult and they needed help. And then as they were using it, they would have problems, questions, and having somebody that they could ask those questions to was something that became very important. We discovered that people, in terms of sustained use, things happened in people's lives. And in particular, we learned that there were often pivotal events in people's lives that very much changed their use of the trackers, such as a family illness, death of a spouse, retirement, travel. And most people got back to the tracker when they could, and even were able to maintain at least smaller amounts of activity during a period where they, rather than just completely stopping their exercise. In terms of the behavior change, we were really excited to see that, as we suspected, most people did not know their baseline activity level, so the tracker had significant immediate educational value, and that people were able to see the impact short-term of changes that they were making in their behavior, and that was very encouraging for them, as opposed to waiting before they could go down a size in their clothes or that they saw a movement on the scale. People also commented that even seeing the tracker on their wrist was a visual reminder of their commitment to fitness. So we have a paper that we published about this, and I want to address some of the ongoing initiatives we have. Because we're very interested in working with clinical care teams, we started something called Tracker Lending Library, where we're providing trackers to physicians in low-income areas to essentially lend to a patient and then to talk about it with the patient at follow-up visits. We're working with an organization, Huts for Vets, that does a wilderness-based training program. And we've been conducting a study looking at integration of tracker data into clinical care, and in particular, how can physicians use data in a condensed display to provide more tailored physical activity advice. I didn't mention here, but one of the other areas that we're really excited about is understanding more about the impact of poor digital literacy skills on tracker adoption and use, not just the physical tracker itself, but the associated app. So before I turn it back to Lauren, I just want to say that I'm really excited that we will be working with the VA, and we hope to be running a pilot with a donation of 200 trackers that we're receiving from Withings through Recycle Health. Here's a picture of me with some of my interns. One of the enormous advantages of running a nonprofit at a university is that I have incredible students who come and work with me. At this point, I'd like to turn it back to Lauren.
Thank you so much. So I think I might be stealing Rob's thunder, but if anybody has any questions, please type them in the question box so that we can bring them up. Rob, are there any other instructions?
No. If audience members, if you have questions, please do enter them into the questions pane of the GoToWebinar dashboard. I think that's what Lauren just said. Sorry, I was distracted. And Lauren, I can ask these questions, or you can do it.
I'm happy to do it if that works.
Yep.
So there were two questions during our first presentation. The first one is from David Goodrich. Were rates of obesity among Asian American veterans adjusted for the lower cut point for individuals from Asia, India, and Pacific Islanders?
No, I don't know if you... That is an important future step, because that I think that'll probably increase, I mean, it will increase the proportion of veterans in that group who are at risk, which is really what we care about more than whatever their specific BMI number may be. So it's a great idea for next steps.
And then we have one other question that popped up during your presentation. It's from Mallory Jacobs, and she asked, what about age? Is there a positive correlation between age and obesity in retirees? She writes, I believe the 2014 outpatient data found that 80% of retirees were overweight or obese.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the rates are relatively high across all groups. So, yeah, we don't know whether people were working or not, but in terms of people 65 and older, we saw that their rates were, you know, a little bit lower than the population mean, but still, you know, in the high 30%.
Thank you. So I saw the link about the obesity fact sheet. I will sort that out because it seemed to work for me when I posted it. So I'll make sure that that is taken care of my afternoon, since I am East Coast and will be done by close of business. Make sure it still works. And then it seems like Angela Lee has a beginning of a question. Trackers that require smartphones versus those that don't. Have you seen any, I don't see the, oh, here we go. Have you seen any barriers to use? So Lisa, trackers require smartphones versus those that don't. Have you seen any barriers to their use?
Yeah, that's a great question, and thank you for asking that. Because a lot of the work that we have done has been with older adults in lower income communities, one of the things that we were actually surprised is that when we were providing trackers to people, we had some age restrictions and that people needed to own a smartphone. We very quickly discovered that when we say own a smartphone, sometimes these were their kids' cast-off iPhone 5. These were pay-as-you-go plans. And so people were not necessarily able to download apps. We also discovered that many people had a fully functioning smartphone, but they had never downloaded it or set up an app themselves. And that's one of the reasons that we got so interested in some of these issues around digital literacy skills. And, you know, a certain fluency with digital literacy really became necessary for people to use trackers, and that people needed to have certain types of smartphones in order to set up a tracker. The number of trackers that are available that don't require a smartphone are very limited, and most of them are clip-on devices. And so that in itself becomes a limitation for people who are interested in using one. You know, even where we found in our pilot study that people liked seeing the tracker on their wrist as a reminder of their commitment to activity and getting some information at a glance about how they've done so far at achieving their goal. If you have a clip-on tracker or one that you're wearing in your pocket, you don't get that kind of information. So the technology definitely can be a limitation, and I think that's something that is becoming more and more of a limitation with the increasingly sophisticated digital health devices that are out there.
Thank you. We have a question from Dr. Moy. Health at Office of Health Equity's Executive Director. He asks, do we know anything about the natural history of weight loss? Do people require multiple attempts? What's the average rate of weight loss? Does this vary across racial and ethnic groups? So I don't know if you all have any insight into that.
This is Jessica. I don't have any specific data on the racial ethnic differences, but I think it's probably the case that most people attempt weight loss more than one time. It does seem like our bodies don't like to give up weight once we've accumulated it. So I think it's a great question and an interesting thing to think about investigating in the future, because I think it is also nice to be able to give people realistic expectations for whatever they're trying to do, sort of similar to what Lisa was saying about the 10,000 goal and whether that's the right one for everybody. I think weight loss goals may function in the same way.
Great, thank you. And he had a follow-up question. Is the use of trackers different when data are uploaded into a dashboard that they could explore? So Lisa, I don't know if you have any insight into that.
But what we've discovered is that a lot of the people that we have worked with don't really use the apps as heavily as they use the tracking device itself. So for people, and then amongst people who use the apps, we find people with very varying levels of sophistication, so that some people use the built-in dashboards. Some people will use other apps that allow them to also input their calories and additional health indicators. I think people are quite different in what they do, and then also the apps are quite different. And certainly one of the questions that we've had is even how these get introduced to people. So working with older adults, I am often going out with my graduate students, and we're sitting down and we're helping people to set up the tracker, set up the app. We're showing them how to make changes in the app, how to use it. And so we're giving them ways to do this easily, and we're making sure that they're comfortable with this before we leave. I think for people who are doing this on their own without any kind of support. It probably depends on what their digital literacy skills are to start with and how much they like to explore the capabilities of a new app in order to see what kind of information they can get. But that being said, it's a great question, and it would be, I should go and add that to that long list that I presented of things that I would like to answer at some point in my research on trackers.
So we have a follow-up question to that. When people are given trackers, do they feel encouraged to start being active, and does it help them engage in regular physical activity? Do you think the tracker helps with that?
What we've discovered is that the trackers do very much help. And going back to that question, you know, so for instance, we just passed the holiday season, and trackers are a popular gift. The only data I have is that Recycle Health gets a large number of unopened boxes of trackers in the months following the Christmas season. And I think that's because people get unwanted gifts. For people who start using a tracker, I think that most of them find it extremely helpful and encouraging. And probably the two most significant things, one is that it can be such a wake-up call for somebody who doesn't know what their baseline activity level is. And the other is when people get that advice of take the stairs instead of the elevator, or park at the end of the parking lot, not the closest spot, you don't really see the impact of that unless you have the tracking device. And what we find is that a lot of people find that extremely encouraging. We've had many people in our studies say to us that they'll get to the end of the day, they'll see that they have a couple hundred steps left in order to reach their goal, and they'll go take a walk around the block or go up and down the stairs a few times in order to do that. So people do become goal-oriented as a result of seeing this information displayed.
Great. And so I have another question from Crystal Neal that I'm actually going to tweak a little bit. She asks about how a VA would start the implementation progress for a program within one of our community living centers, which is a long-term care physical rehab program. If I were to expand that and say, you know, if people on the call are interested in connecting with you about Recycle Health, if people are interested in doing something with trackers at their medical center, how would they get going? How would they connect with you? Kind of what would be next steps if they're looking to do more?
We would be delighted to work with any organization that's interested in getting trackers. Our limitation is the number of trackers that we have, and also that we've been fortunate enough to have some donations of new trackers, but many of the trackers that we have are people's old trackers that we clean and refurbish and then can provide to people. So, you know, that's our limitation. But the best thing to do is to contact me through my email address, lisa.gualteri@tufts.edu, or to go to the website for Recycle Health, which is just recyclehealth.com. And we have some information there if you're requesting trackers. And also for anybody who has trackers that are sitting in their junk drawer or at the bottom of their gym bag, please consider donating them to us as well so that we're able to serve more people with these trackers.
Thank you. It looks like we're coming up at the top of the hour. I just want to make one last comment. Sarah Grandy had mentioned the Move Mobile Coach app is a great resource. It is now available for Android and Apple products. So if somebody's looking for something to recommend today, that there's a resource that we have available at our fingertips. And then one last quick question to you, Lisa. Do trackers need to be working, or can you fix them? So if you receive a donation, do they have to be in working order, or do you have the ability to refurbish them?
At Recycle Health, we try very hard to fix any trackers that come in that aren't broken. So sometimes it's just cosmetic damage, or it's swapping in a new band. If a tracker doesn't work, we'll do our best to do that. That being said, if I can be allowed to end on a funny note, we ended up with a box of trackers that we absolutely could not fix. And my 10-year-old nephew was visiting me one day and started taking apart the trackers. And we took out the circuit boards in the trackers, and some of my graduate students started making circuit board earrings out of these trackers. We think that they're lovely, and we also feel like we're making a statement about electronic waste. And then, of course, we recycle responsibly the batteries and the other components from the trackers.
Fantastic. Thank you. Well, it is almost 1 o'clock, so I do want to close and thank everybody. I want to thank Dr. Breland and Dr. Gualtieri for taking the time to be here and present and share all of the knowledge that they have with us. I really enjoyed having you both and for agreeing to be a part of this effort. Thank you, Rob, for all of your work arranging everything. And thanks to all of you on the call. And I really hope that this was helpful. I believe the slides, I know there are questions about slides, I believe they will be available for download, if I am correct.
Yeah, Lauren, the slides are available for download, and I just sent that link to everybody in the chat. So I had a problem earlier, but that's been fixed. And audience members, you will receive an email in the next couple days with a link, the same link that was in the email that you received this morning.
And just finally, please don't hesitate to reach out to me if there's ever anything I can do. I am the only core shock in the entire VA, so I can't hide. But please let me know if there's anything I can do to support your efforts. So thank you, everybody, for joining us this afternoon.
I'd like to repeat Dr. Korshak's thanks, and attendees, please do stick around and fill out the very short survey that comes up when I close the webinar momentarily. Once again, thank you, Lisa, Jessica, and Lauren, and have a good day, everybody.